I'd like to call to order today's meeting, the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, March 28, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland? Cornish?
Here.
Ellison? Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Meslow? Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Chair notes the presence of a quorum, so we will take up the minutes first from the previous meeting, March 23rd, 2006. They are in the pack. Is there a motion? Representative Newman moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, next thing we'll do is take up House File 1443, Representative Emmer. Photo ID must be displayed at polling places. This bill is currently on our table. The chair removes it from the table for purposes of the A3 amendments. The amendment eliminates the fiscal impact, providing for a provisional ballot. My intent to move the amendment. Chairman so moves. Discussion on that amendment. Removing the fiscal impact. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 1443 as amended is before us. Chair would move that the bill be recommended to pass and be returned to the general register. Discussion on that. Hearing none, those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is moved. House File 3312, Representative Holberg. Members, committee administrator reminded me, according to what is on our agenda, that we've heard this bill. It's on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus safety bill. There is no fiscal impact. Representative Holberg asked that we, and the chair hereby does, take the bill off the table and would move that we recommend it to pass, be moved back to the general register. Any questions on that? Thirty-three twelve as amended is before us. Any discussion on the motion? Those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 3389, Representative Cornish, Classified Data, BCA's Name and Event Index Service. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 3389.
Representative Cornish, why don't you move the bill and then for possible inclusion?
Please. I'd like to move House File 3389. Mr. Chair, what is your understanding where this is good to go? To the been in civil law already. Does this go to the general register?
Representative Cornish, last night's Civil Law Committee waived that request.
So then the move would be to register.
Move the bill and then we'll lay it over. After the move your bill as you did and proceed, and then at the end we'll chair will lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 3389 is what's called the NEES bill, and it's a name event indexing established here by the BCA. They're creating an indexing service of individuals that have had contact with the criminal justice system. What this does and doesn't do, what it does is it collects information. It's not a new system for collecting information. It doesn't create a new database, and it protects the classification of data that's already contained in the criminal justice system. What it does is similar to a library card, where it indexes the library card to various books. This service here simply is a connection between a person's name and the events that are contained in different agencies or databases in the criminal justice system. And once again, what it does not do, it doesn't create a new database, and it doesn't make information any more unprotected than it was. It contains the same classification, whether private or confidential, in the wherever this information came from. So it's just a simple way of attaching a catalog card with as a person's name to various pieces of information. And it might add, in the committee before, there was nobody opposing this, and it went through without any opposition from anybody that I know of.
Any questions from any member of the committee of the author? My understanding, Representative Cornish, you do have folks in the room if there are questions.
Is
there anyone present in the audience wishing to be heard in testimony on House File 3389? Please raise your hand now. Nobody. Any questions? Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Cornish, let's move on to your next item. House File 3359, CrimNet Policy Group Changes. Move the bill, and then we'll lay it over at the end as well.
I'd like to move this bill, and would the next stop be the General Register, or does this have to make a stop?
I'm sorry, I lost.
Move to the General Register, or does it have to make a stop? Or the impossible inclusion into the
omnibus
bill? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3359, Criminal Juvenile Task Force, CrimNet, the task force of which I'm a member. What this bill does is add a position to the task force, and it's appointed by the state chief information officer, and the bill also provides a stipend for the four citizen members of the Criminal Justice Juvenile Task Force. What this is we were required, the CrimNet is, to come to the legislature every year and make recommendations for legislative activity. And this is one of those suggestions, House File 3359. So it adds one position to the task force, and it provides a stipend for the four citizen members. This would be a meeting, I think, once a month as usual, and the fiscal impact, there is one, but it's minimal, and it's planned to be absorbed by the operating budget of CrimNet, about $2,640 per year.
Any questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3359? Please raise your hand now. Nobody. Any questions? Chair, then we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Johnson, House File 3987. Yeah. Representative Johnson, we after yours, we do have four other bills, and we have a short hearing this morning. Let's see if we can conclude all of our business before we have to go to session. House File 3987. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House File 3987 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And, Mr. Chairman, this is, I believe, $20.2 million that the governor has recommended be spent in the public safety budget, and I think the most efficient way to do this is just to walk through the testifiers and let them talk about their portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So, Representative Mike Beard is first on the list.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Johnson, thanks for including this portion in the House file. Since Scott County has taken over this responsibility, it just makes sense to me to have some of the community corrections money flow to Scott County for picking up the slack and, in my opinion, doing an even better job.
All right, Representative Johnson, you do have some agency people here. If there are questions on this item, are there any questions at this time from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on this particular aspect of the bill? Raise your hand. Okay. Representative Johnson.
All right. Since he is up here, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll have Representative Tony Cornish speak next about his portion of the bill.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman, members, the portion of the bill is the illegal immigration enforcement team, the MITE, or however they pronounce the acronym. And what it is the enforcement of illegal immigration, the state, in cooperation of task force with the state and federal authorities. It would be a team of at least 10 law enforcement officers within the state assigned to this task force, and they would receive extensive training before they were allowed to actually form into the team, and the identification database training, racial profiling training, all sorts of detention, arrest, and civil rights training would be part of this training that they would get before they formed into the 10-man team, and certain information would be required to be in the database and furnished to for the record keeping of the unit, the illegal immigration enforcement team.
Questions? Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, tell me what this these 10 new officers are going to be doing. What kind of what are their responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, you want me to have Department of Public Safety or DPS?
Mary Ellison or someone from DPS?
I could give you a general description if you want. Technically.
Mr. O'Malley, have a seat, identify yourself, and then begin the answer.
Tim O'Malley, Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the 10 agents in the immigration bill, our plan right now would be to have one agent assigned to be a sort of a training and liaison agent with the communities most affected by this bill. We had an impartial policing conference in St. Cloud last year where we brought in a lot of different representatives from law enforcement from different countries, different cultures, and learned quite a bit about the importance of communication. And I think that for this bill to be successful, for our efforts to be successful, it would be critical that we maintain that contact with the different communities. So that would where one officer would be assigned. We anticipating putting two on the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Task Force to work directly with them. We would probably put one on the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. Two of them, I would anticipate, or about two, would be assigned to the BCA headquarters to work on false identification and fraudulent benefit frauds, those types of investigations. And then at least four would be assigned to field offices around the state. Those exact field offices, I'm not sure of yet. We would certainly get input from local law enforcement, and we'd get input from the communities most affected by this bill and decide where it is that we most would need an agent in the field. That's one critical area in talking to the federal authorities is the ability to have someone with this expertise outside of the metro area to assist local law enforcement when situations arise.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that these officers then are going to be looking for people who are plotting or actually committing crimes in the state of Minnesota. Are they also going to be checking the immigration status of immigrants.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the first. No one at the BCA or anyone that I've talked to in the commissioner's office here, as we've talked about how to best implement this and make it most effective to protect Minnesotans and to enforce Minnesota laws so we can do our job better. No one envisions this being some sweep of those who are undocumented. Rather, it's about enforcing state laws better because we have the expertise of knowing what the federal laws allow us to do. But it would be targeting and investigating with locals and with the federal authorities individuals who are involved in a series of different types of crimes, human trafficking, fraud, as I mentioned. Identification fraud is a big problem. And some of those types are in violent crimes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Malley, then, I guess the problem, it just sounds to me like we're adding 10 agents to the BCA, and that's fine with me. If we certainly need the additional agents. But what seems to be a misnomer and seems to, when I see that the $2 million is being appropriated for the Minnesota Illegal Immigration Enforcement Team, that says something very different from what your testimony is. Can you respond to that?
Mr. O'Malley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I would respectfully disagree. This group of 10, while not a team in the concept of 10 of them sitting in the same bay at the BCA and having some special logo on their jacket and a flying squad around the state, we learned from talking to other states, in particular Florida, the best way to be most effective in this arena is to plug into existing networks, to work with the federal agencies, not to create another level of bureaucracy, if you will, another investigative, standalone, independent entity. Instead, to plug into those, yet still have it all together under the BCA and work the fraudulent crimes, the human trafficking, whatever they may be, there is a lot of federal knowledge and some federal resources that we need to tap into and we need to be aware of. And to have 10 people with that expertise within state government to be able to coordinate all that, I think does make a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, is the federal government reimbursing the state at all for the 10 agents?
Mr. O'Malley.
To enforce, basically federal laws?
No.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read the bill here, it says Illegal Immigration Task Force to focus on illegal immigrants who commit these crimes. If you run across people that aren't illegal immigrants doing these crimes, are you just going to say, well, they're not illegal immigrants, so we don't have jurisdiction, so we're going to walk away from them and let them continue doing what they're doing?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, no, we would not walk away from that.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, that was my same line of questioning as well. If they're non-immigrants or non-illegal immigrants that are committing these crimes, do you anticipate that someone else would have jurisdiction over this or that this team would not be the primary focus? Would you turn it over to, more local authorities, or would this group still deal with the issue?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we would deal with the issue. Our focus in the investigations would be to work with these other agencies and target these areas, these areas of concern. Now, if we come across something else during that investigation, we would not ignore it. It would depend on the magnitude of it, I suppose, and if it linked to some of the illegal immigration issues. Just as when we do a search warrant on a drug case, if we come across child pornography, we don't pretend like we don't see it, and we still deal with it. I would envision the same way, but we would not go out with the idea of it being one that the focus was not on those who were here illegally.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Malley, will you go over again where those 10 people are going to be, what they were going to do?
Certainly. We would have one agent assigned to be training and liaison with the communities and training for law enforcement. Training for law enforcement and training for the communities about law enforcement. Anticipate having two of them most likely go on an Immigration and Customs Enforcement Task Force that is just being formed. The federal government has come up with a proposal to establish these task forces in various sites around the United States, and Minneapolis is one of them.
Mr. Chair, the federal government is establishing a task force, and then we're going to send two people there and pay these two people to be part of this task force?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. Very similar to what we do with the Drug Enforcement Administration today, and what we do with, or what we used to do with the Federal Bureau of Investigation when they had their fugitive task force. There's a tremendous benefit for state government to be involved in those. We're catching drug dealers and violent criminals by working jointly with them.
So that's three.
Continuing, there would be, we anticipate two being assigned to the BCA at our headquarters to work primarily on fraud cases, fake identifications. There have been a number of cases where people have obtained government benefits and other benefits. And then anticipate at least four going to our field offices. And those exact locations would be determined later.
And then one more.
I think that's 10. One training, two on the task force is three. One at the FBI is four. Two at headquarters is six. And then at least four in the field offices would be 10.
Anything further?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And then tell me how team differs from task force or a special group. What do you mean by team?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, what we mean is there's task forces around the state in a number of different criminal investigative areas, and they're usually individuals, agents, analysts, police officers from different agencies that band together to address a problem. The team within the BCA would be a group of 10 who have specialized training, who have a greater awareness of the cultural differences, who have a better understanding of what the federal law requires and what authority you have under the federal law. That team would coordinate amongst themselves. We would have a supervisor that would oversee these 10, that would make sure they all work together. Yet, they would be assigned with different entities. To have that team be a team, if you will, that just stands alone and doesn't communicate well with others would be a very ineffective way to do this. But if we can, at the BCA, draw these different entities together, whether it be ICE or whether it be a local agency or the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force or work with Department of Commerce or work with DBS on fake driver's licenses, whatever it could be, if we can draw all that together in one team and then coordinate it, we would be most effective. I mentioned the DEA Task Force before. We have two agents assigned to the DEA Task Force. They're paid by the BCA. Some of their overtime is paid with federal money. But that has worked exceptionally well for us in investigating drug crimes in Minnesota, because when you first start investigating crime, often you're not sure where it's going to end up, whether it's best suited for federal prosecution or state prosecution. So to have some people who understand the federal system and when it comes up to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, know how all that works and can do it, or vice versa, when there's something in the federal system that is better suited to come to the state, we have a direct link, a liaison with those agencies.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Murphy.
Supervisor wouldn't be one of the 10.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no.
And do you envision that at some time down the way then that this team will be wearing special insignia and special jackets, and that the supervisor will be coming here and asking for more money because it's just such a much bigger problem, and that we have to do more to establish just this little portion of that new team effort?
Mr. O'Malley, do you anticipate that?
No.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that this team, I imagine, is going to be peace officers licensed by folks. In addition to their already 2 years of training, they're going to receive extensive training in all the areas you see listed here. And just to give some comfort, this isn't going to be a big sweep like the old INS looking for just illegal people. It says that the team will focus its time and resources on identifying and apprehending illegal immigrants who are involved in felony level criminal activity. So that's what their focus is going to be. It's not a big search for misdemeanors. I mean, this is more serious stuff. And it also, we've been hearing from local law enforcement that this is a burden on them, and they're not looking for unfunded mandate. This is just actually a supplement. This is meant to help them out, not to put additional financial burdens. And this should assist the local law enforcement agency get somewhere to pass off, you know, duties that they don't think they should do.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Cornish. And that was my next point. Mr. O'Malley was Superintendent O'Malley. Was that, as I gather what you're saying, that this is going to be indeed a resource for the communities across the state and the people that are working with in the field offices and so forth. It will be resources that the locals will be able to come to. And that part I'm comfortable with, but setting up a new group that's set apart from the whole group is something that I want to veer away from.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm in complete agreement with you.
We have Representative Eastland, then Ellison, then Hilston. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Cornish's comments. It's easy to understand that, you know, we want to have effective enforcement in when there's terrorism, when there's drug running, when there's human trafficking, when there's all of those things. But, you know, I think that the thing that I'm concerned about is just the sheer magnitude of this issue. You know, I mean, I think the estimates are 11 to 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States. If you just spread that out evenly among states, I don't know if that's how it goes, but I mean, there'd be 400,000 immigrants illegally in our state. Some of them have been here a long time. Some of them are married. Their wife or husband may be a citizen. They have kids. They're born here. They're citizens. And so now we have an illegal immigrant who has a wife and her husband is a citizen, and we have kids that are citizens, and our only option is to treat them like an illegal immigrant. And what do? You send them back. You know, I think what we're doing here is we're creating a really difficult to enforce solution from the human perspective. This issue is bigger than Minnesota, way bigger than Minnesota. And we need a comprehensive plan so that if we find immigrants that are here illegally, that it just is not practical from a human standpoint to send back. We need to have options for them. There needs to be some work permits. There need to be an expedited way to get a visa. There needs to be some other things in play here other than just give them a ticket back to wherever they came from. And I understand what you're saying is the focus here is not going to be on those people. But I think that's the concern I have is when a process starts, there can be some overzealous enforcement, and all of a sudden it can enter into those people. And quite frankly, I think when we do that, we're getting really into the federal policy question that we need to have answered before we go down this road too far. So that's just a comment that I have. And I think we're making some statements here about what we think about people who are here illegally. And I think we really need to think through what that means when we think of the magnitude of this issue and the number of human beings that we're talking about and the human cost of what we're talking about doing. And if we're going to put them in prison and spend $30,000 a year or whatever, I mean, we have some trade-offs here we have to talk about and figure out if this is the best policy for our state, for our country. So I just think we need to slow down on this enough so that we are working in concert with the federal government, not out in front doing some things that we may be sorry for later.
Okay, members, we have Representatives Ellison, then Hilstrom, and then Murphy again, and just a gentle reminder from the chair. This particular matter is scheduled Wednesday night for a full policy review. We are hearing the budget request. We've heard from Mr. O'Malley where the 10 agents are slated to go. I think that he's answered the question. Now let's have Representative Ellison, then Hilstrom, and then Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, with that gentle warning, I'll be very brief, sir. I just wanted to say that I agree entirely with what Representative Eastland said, and I just want to make sure that our BCA agents are enforcing crime, focused on crime, not somebody who just came here because they needed to work. And I guess what I'm hearing from you, Representative Cornish, and you, Mr. O'Malley, is that these 10 agents aren't going to be trolling South Minneapolis looking for Hispanic men and women who are playing volleyball and get up against the wall, show me your papers kind of business. I hope that's not what they're going to be doing. And what I'm from hearing from you is that's not what they're going to be doing. They're going to be fighting crime. Am I right about that?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, absolutely. In fact, I'd go a step further and say that one of our main goals would be to afford greater protection to some of those who are here illegally for work purposes, for family purposes, are not committing violent crimes, and yet don't have access to some of our systems because they're here illegally. And they are far and away a high percentage of the victims, and whether it's human trafficking or in some of the drug dealing. I could cite a number of cases, we don't have time now, but those are some of the people that we have a very grave interest in protecting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak briefly with Representative Cornish. The bill that we're going to hear on Wednesday has a provision that false documents are going to be a felony. So in essence, if we're just going to focus on felons, we're just creating a whole new class of felons, and I don't know that 10 new agents are going to take care of that whole issue. So I look forward to the further discussion about the issue on Wednesday.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent O'Malley, can you break down the employment costs for these 10 people? What will be salary and what will be training? And are they going to be competitive? Are they going to have the same salary as other BCA agents that are hired? Or are they going to be enhanced?
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, they would be treated as other BCA agents. Historically, when something like this happens, we give the option to current agents who may have an interest in moving into this arena, and then we may hire to backfill those. So some of our current agents may move into this and receive the extra training.
So they may have different salaries in that sense. And, Mr. Chair, Superintendent O'Malley, then what is the sum of money that you are anticipating a BCA officer? One of these 10 new positions will cost for benefits and salary and training.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I know a fiscal note has been prepared. I don't have that number right in front of me, but we have a very precise number for each of the agents.
I'd like to see it.
Okay.
Good. Anything further? Any other questions? Representative Johnson, can you move us along? We have the minority leader coming in at 11. Like, I'd prefer not to detain him if possible.
Right. Next on my list, then, is Mr. Benson from the Department of Corrections.
Commissioner, on the salary supplement and the mentoring, you did brief us on this about a week ago, but please review it at this time.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dennis Benson, the Deputy Commissioner for Corrections. We'll go through this very, very quickly. We did give you an overview last week. To cut to the chase, our salary supplement request, which is exclusively for inflation, staff salary inflation, is $3.213 million in 06 and $10.1 million in 07. This is the difference between the savings and our needs, the bed rental savings. As we explained to you last week, we do have some savings from bed rental. Fiscal year 06 is $6.1 million. Fiscal year 07, the savings is $8.5 million. The actual inflation is close to right around $28 million, so you subtract the savings from the savings, and that gets you to the $13.3 million that we're requesting. I'd just like to make sure the committee understands that this is going exclusively for inflation. We're not adding positions. We've got heating bill problems in our agency up to about $3 million this year. We're anticipating that next year those utility bills are going to leave us with about a $4 million hole in our budget. In addition to that, we have an unfunded health care problem. This year it's probably under $1 million, but next year we're believing it's going to be $1.5 million in the contract and probably another $1 million in salaries. Those issues we will address next year when we present our biannual budget request. But to get us through until next year, we are asking for the $3 million this year, $10 million next year, and it's critical to our ongoing operation. We have, as I mentioned last week, done all the double bunking we can. We have no other space inside of our system other than renting beds, and of course, that's a COD charge. We have to pay those bills every month. So the notion that we can somehow squeeze more money out of this budget, it just isn't there at this time. Past years, we were able to open a dorm, add something somewhere. We can't do that anymore. We're renting beds. We pay that invoice every month. And while the growth has slowed, there's still growth. We're still growing at 4 to 5% a year, and we are pleading for these dollars as we can't cut security staffing in our institutions any further than we already have. In addition to the salary supplement, we're also carrying in our budget the $300,000 for child mentoring that Ms. Cornelius will mention in a minute. And you already heard about the CCA, Scott County CCA request of $196,000. So with that, I'll ask Ms. Cornelius to comment on mentoring.
Go right ahead.
For the record, my name is Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. I believe a question came up last week regarding how many children this $300,000 would serve. And based on the program developed by Big Brothers Big Sisters, as an example, $300,000 should be able to serve about 400 kids. And again, there are about 7,500 kids in Minnesota that have an incarcerated parent. And in Hennepin and Ramsey County alone, it's just over 3,200.
Any questions of either witness? Representative Johnson, thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you. I think for now we'll skip over Representative Newman and move to Ms. Dodge in the post board.
I think we have Neil Melton coming down. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Post Board, and I shall be brief. This is about money. I'm here to explain the governor's supplemental budget appropriation to the Post Board. The background is that in 2005, the omnibus bill included a $20 reinstatement fee dedicated to the Post Board to increase reimbursement to local units of government, or CE, or continuing education training for officers. The fee, as designed, was expected to generate $763,000 in fiscal year 06 and $832,000 in 07. However, the new projections indicate that the fee will collect only $100,000 in 06 and $115,000 in 07. The governor's recommendation is to supplement that difference. Now, the result to the increase in the training for officers is that the officers would receive a $100 increase, bringing them up to $455. And the chart you have in your packet shows the funding reimbursement history from 1987 to 2005. The increase is projected to bring us back up to where we were in 1989, 17 years ago. So the reimbursement has been steadily decreasing, and we would hope to offset that with that increase from the government.
Very good. Any questions? Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Kevin Kyer.
Excuse me. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Before you is a request for trial transcripts for our appellate office of $200,000 a year. It's basically here for four reasons. One is the tremendous increase in the number of cases that we have in the appellate office, the increase in the complexity and the length of those trials and thus the transcripts, the increase in the per-page rate and the elimination of mandatory transcripts, which I know you all discussed a couple of years ago. So that's basically why the request is here. As some of you have been around a while know, this is a perennial problem that we have in the appellate office, and we've run out of money.
Any questions of Mr. Kier? Thank you, sir. Representative Johnson.
Representative Meslow has a piece on the Internet crimes against children.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Johnson and Representative Hillstrom offered some very compelling information and testimony on the Internet crimes against children that are going on right now, the child pornography, the attempts to recruit children through the Internet. St. Paul has been receiving a federal grant for some time now to address that. They've got a 10-person task force. We think that grant money is likely to continue, but we'd like to supplement that and also fully extend their jurisdiction statewide. And that's what House File 3725 does, is that expands that so that it will be a statewide task force. We base it out of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We've got the space to be able to do that. The state funding that we're talking about in terms of supplementing that budget is $1 million. We think that there's an awful lot of good that's going to be able to be done with that. And so we're asking that be included in the bill that Representative Johnson has been brought forward. I should clarify, those dollars would be used in part for enforcement. They'd also be in part be used for prevention. That some of that would be a matter of developing programs to educate children and parents to help protect them against the Internet crimes, as well as personnel training funds for enforcement and continuing to catch the people who are committing these truly horrific crimes.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, next on my list is a representative from the Department of Public Safety, and I'm not sure who is.
Mary Ellison is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm here to briefly describe three items in the governor's supplemental budget. The first one is a request for state disaster match funds. This change totals $284,000. That's the request. And it's for match costs related to three past disaster declarations. And they involve local government disaster costs for a storm in the city of Hastings in 2001. Cost overruns from the 1998 tornado disaster in St. Peter, and costs associated with the recent disaster declaration for nine counties in western Minnesota that suffered damage because of the storms in November of 2005. We do have an ongoing state disaster match budget, but we have the costs that we are being requested to provide exceed that by $284,000. So that's that request. The next one is a request for $200,000 in 07 and $116,000 in 08 and 09 for posting of non-compliant sex offenders on the web-based system that the DCA operates. This proposal would enhance the capability of the predatory offender database to allow the publishing on the Internet of information about non-compliant sex offenders. The last one is a request for $100,000 for 07 and also for 08 and 09. This initiative is to prevent underage drinking, and it's to provide a training to new licensed alcohol vendors in the state of Minnesota. The program is designed to prevent sale of alcohol to underage persons.
Thank you. Any questions? Very good.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to number four on the list, Representative Newman, and you can come forward. I don't know if there's anyone here from the board on judicial standards or not, but that is the piece.
Representative Newman, have a seat and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My part on this involves the Board of Judicial Standards. I have with me Mr. Paul, who is the Executive Secretary of the Judicial Standards, and he would be able to address the funding in the bill of 172 plus. I would ask leave from the chair to allow him to discuss some additional base funding that the board is requesting for that would be for informational purposes this morning.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, members, the $172,000 deficiency appropriation represents four actions that the board is currently pursuing. The first two are publicly disclosed, and they are the hearings for Judge Murphy and Judge Stacy. They'll be coming up in about another 4 to 6 weeks. We have attorneys for both those cases, and of course those attorneys are applying investigators and other staff. The other two items are, first, we have a serious matter in out of the metro area, up north that we are investigating. This is requiring a great deal of attention and funds, and there is another matter which is even farther out state, which is represents a complaint by a group of county workers, which is appears to be very serious, and we have found it necessary to employ an investigator for that also.
Thank you for that general description, Representative Murphy.
Just to point, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Paul, the group of county workers are not in Minnesota, or they're in far away?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
Representative Murphy, they are in Minnesota. They're just not in the metro area. Sorry if you misunderstood me.
Any questions on this? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my last witness is you to talk about the court's funding piece.
Representative Smith, are you going to stay in your station there?
Mr. Chairman, members, this has been heard before. This is the recommendation and request from the Alcohol and Other Drug Task Force appointed by the Supreme Court. The final $750,000 in the governor's budget request would be spent for training for judges, lawyers, and others. It would be for a study of the cost and funding of these cases. It's for a pilot project for a multi-county drug court and for chemical dependency treatment funds to help with the courts. The overall approach would be to assist the growing network of drug courts and problem-solving courts.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have on the bill. I would appreciate the consideration by the committee.
All right. If there's no other questions, Chair, we'll lay your bill over.
Thank you.
And at this point, I would call Representative Intenza, House File 3572. Reimbursement for out-of-area service by bomb squad.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning. Chair will move House File 3572. And at the conclusion of your testimony, the Chair will lay it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Matt Intenza, and with me is the Chief of the Bloomington Police Department, John Locke. And to my other side, Officer Marty Early from the Bloomington Police Department, who formerly headed up the bomb squad offices there. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. We're very fortunate in Minnesota. We have four departments that provide coverage for the entire state for emergencies involving either possible or actual explosive devices. The City of Bloomington is the lead there, along with the Crowing County Sheriff's Department and the City of Brainerd, the police departments of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I was just talking with the Commissioner of Public Safety, and about 10 years ago, we reached, I think, an important compromise. These departments provided services to other cities, and they used to then charge a nominal fee to other cities for the use of their services. And occasionally what we find is other cities would decline to call them in to try and save a little money, but then their officers who didn't have proper training would be put at risk attempting to ascertain if a device could be defused or if it was indeed an explosive device. So about 10 years ago, in a bipartisan effort, about $50,000 was set aside to help reimburse those departments for their out-of-jurisdiction runs. Unfortunately, since 911, they've had lots of additional calls. What this bill would do is provide the reimbursement so that these communities, which are now having to eat those costs and it's resulting in less training money being available, would no longer have to do it. I'm pleased that you and a number of Republican authors are on as co-sponsors. This is, I think, just an entirely bipartisan effort to make sure that we do right by these officers and make sure that we've got the coverage we need throughout the state. And I know which one of you gentlemen wants to go first. Mr. Chair, with your permission, if Officer Early could go first.
Officer Early, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Marty Early. I'm the sergeant with the Bloomington Police Department, and up until the first of this year, I was the commander of our bomb squad, where I had been assigned for the last 13 years. And having all 10 of my fingers, I decided it was time for me to resign and move on. However, there is one piece of important legislation that I think needs to be taken care of, and that is what we're here about today. There are 4 bomb squads in the state of Minnesota. All 4 of those squads respond anywhere in the state of Minnesota via a call from the Minnesota State Duty Officer. It doesn't matter if we're going up north, down south, east or west, each team will go anywhere. All 4 of these teams are trained identically the same. We all go to Huntsville, Alabama for a 6-week training school, which is the basic training, which that cost is bared by our cities for our expenses while we are gone. Then we are required every 3 years to attend a 1-week training session again in Huntsville, Alabama to keep our current certification. Prior to any money being given to us by the cities, or by the state, I'm sorry, when cities would call us and ask us to respond to their cities, and we would tell them we were billing them $150 per hour from the time we left in our vehicle to the time we parked our vehicle, they would get very quiet on the other end, and they would say, we'll call you right back. After a couple hours, we'd make a call back to them and ask them what happened, and the responses we got were disturbing. We took care of it. Well, how did you take care of it? The way they took care of it ranged from we threw it in the river, we threw it in the dump, we took a shot at it with a high-powered rifle, or in a lot of cases, the chief came in and opened it up and decided it wasn't a bomb. Luckily, nobody got hurt doing that yet. And the state stepped in and started reimbursing us, and that took care of that problem. However, in this fiscal year, all 4 bomb squads have already spent their money in the first 2 quarters of this year, meaning that our cities are now on the hook paying our fees when we go out to render safe devices throughout the state of Minnesota. Fortunately, we have chiefs like my chief who are willing to pay that bill. However, the cost is getting to be so astronomical, it's time that we get a little extra money. And that's why we're here today. All we're asking you for today is money to reimburse us when we leave our jurisdictions and help out another city. We're not asking you to help us pay for the almost $45,000 a year that we pay in Bloomington to our bomb squad members for the minimum training necessary to stay qualified. All we are asking for is the money to reimburse us when we leave our cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Officer Early. Chief Locks.
Mr. Chair and members, Sergeant Early and Representative Intenzo have hit all the high points. Let me just make 2. That this is a reimbursement. We don't get the money up front. It sits in a fund that we draw down. So for some reason we didn't respond to those numbers, we would not draw the money. It's not given to us up front. It's a fairness issue for me. As administrator of a department, I feel that I should not have to subsidize my employees going to other parts of the state to render devices safe. And we gladly do it, but at some point the citizens of the 4 cities that host bomb squads should at least be able to recover out of jurisdiction expenses just for the runs, not for the training, not for the $350,000 bomb truck and all the other equipment that we have. This is a huge expense that we went into with our eyes open. But this reimbursement, I think, is just a simple issue of fairness. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Eastland and Murphy. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is good good thing here. I was just kind of curious, how many of the devices that you, when you're called out to evaluate a device and disarm it, how many of them turn out to be bombs? What percentage of them?
You know, Mr. Chair, what I'd like to point out, first of all, is that we only respond if you have a device or a suspicious package. We do not respond on threats or searches for anything. Currently, last week when I spoke to the other bomb squads, we are running at about 75 to 80% of the calls that were going on outside of our jurisdictions as being some type of either made to look like improvised explosive device or an actual device.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, but I guess the question is, of the devices that you go out and you actually look at, how many of them actually turn out to be a bomb, something that would explode? If they, not a bomb threat, but when you're actually called to look at something and say, we think this thing is a bomb, how many of them are actually bombs?
Of the actual bombs themselves, we're probably running right around the 70% range. I'm saying 75 to 80% are made to either look like devices, with 70% roughly are being live devices.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Antenna.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, unfortunately, we've had about a 250% increase in the number of calls just over the last 2 years, these bomb squads. And so they are getting, it's just been very dramatic. And the last time that the state appropriation was set and it's been flat is about 10 years ago. So we haven't had any change. And compared to, I'm sure, other things you'll see, I think $55,000 is pretty nominal. We could all wish all of our bills were this inexpensive.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair. Chief Mount, could you explain to, for the record, as well as you explained to me before the meeting, why there's a disparity between 15,000, and 7,500 per wing?
Chief Locke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the state duty officer is the one that actually assigns the bomb squads to respond depending on geographical and availability considerations. And the Crow Wing County Brainerd shared responsibility based on past history would be compensated at the proper rate. The three bomb squads in the metro area take care of the metro and north metro and everything down to the Iowa border. Our experience has been there just hasn't been as many devices in the northern third of the state, and so it's based on the history of response, not on any other criteria.
Very good. Representative Cornish.
Just a quick question, as long as we got him here. On my retirement party, some bonehead gave me 3 sticks of dynamite. In fact, it was professionally done, stenciled dynamite with coils going around a little clock, and for a present. When I got it, I didn't know what the heck to do with it. So I take it out to the dump, I throw it out the back of my truck, and once you know it, somebody backs right up next to me and looks down and sees that thing, gets big eyes. I said, it's fake, you know. And what do you do in a case like that? These things are actually manufactured. If you get one of those, what do you advise people to do?
Officer Early.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you, first of all, because that was overtime for me that day when we came out and took care of it for you. Actually, that's not totally unusual, but we do a lot of training across the state of Minnesota for officers since 9/11, and one of the things we do is teach them really to evaluate what they're looking at. In a lot of cases, something like that is a toy, and it's very obvious, and the officers, because of the training we're giving them for free, are learning not to call us on those type of things. We get there and we look at it. Our basic mode of operation is one officer goes up, takes a quick x-ray of it, make sure that there's certain things we look for. If they're not there, we just pick it up and take it apart.
Thank you.
Good. Representative Intenz, I know we do have representatives from the Department of Public Safety here, and we will be working our omnibus bill next week, and I know they'll be back in the audience, so I guess I would just like to instruct them right now to take another look at the bomb squad fund, and if there is funding available, to not wait until this bill would be included and passed and signed, but to get those checks cut within the next week or so. So I will remember this bill, in as much as I'm a co-author, next week, and I may raise that question then. So I'd ask them to take another look at their account fund this week. Gentlemen, Chief, Sergeant, Representative Tenza, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to continue and try to get the remaining three bills in the next 25 minutes if we can, so we can all make it to session. Representative Murphy, House File 3869, Funds for Victim Intervention Program, Inc.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, in your packet are two letters that I received from people supporting this, and then there's a packet of letters that came with the supporters of the Victims Intervention Program, and they are looking to expand across the metro area, and they are looking for funds to help them do that because there are so many calls for their services. Sue Mahar is here to tell you what the goal of Victims Intervention Program is, and then, Mr. Chair, I move that this be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Murphy, thank you for that motion. That is before us. First, let's go to Ms. Meyer. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman and members. I'm going to share with you briefly, as much as I can, a quick capsulization of why I know about VIPI and why I believe and have the reason to come and ask for VIPI support today. It's a program that provides support services for homicide, suicide, and accidental death victims and their families. Any kind of loved ones involved in that situation can receive assistance through the VIPI program. The programs are currently housed in the St. Paul and Minneapolis homicide units of both departments. The relationships that have taken place between the department and the families and the community and everybody involved is extremely important in getting things together and as healed as possible when it completes itself. 8 years ago, on January 31st, my son Joshua was 22 years old, and he was murdered. In St. Paul, he was kidnapped, he was bound, he was gang beaten, he was raped, he was stabbed, and left to bleed to death in his car. I can tell you, when I got that death notification, my life turned upside down and inside out. I had no idea how to help myself face what I was facing, much less my surviving son, who was then 19. Without VIPI, I can only imagine the anger, bitterness, revenge, and heartache we might still be suffering today. Because the program was available to me, they reached out, they put themselves in my place and showed me the way to help myself and my family. And my extended family, my son's friends, all kinds of ripples in the pool that were hugely important to healing and coming to some way of accepting where our life went. VIPI is a very unique organization. It was developed by a woman that also faced homicide, her husband's. And most recently now, she has faced the accidental death of her son just a few weeks ago. He was killed in a snowmobile accident. She now belongs to two of the three groups that she services. The needs have grown immensely in the 8 years I've been involved with the program. We have two paid positions. The rest of it is entirely volunteer. People like myself that go through the program then give back to the program. We help facilitate groups. So like when I came in, there were people there facing me that had walked in my shoes. I gave that back to the people coming after me and show them hope and purpose in putting this kind of a happening into your life. The death of a loved one in this way so abruptly, it can so violently blindside your life. It's an easy way to help create further perpetrators. The program is extremely valuable because it does just the opposite. I saw my 19-year-old son sit in a group with other young adults who were facing now the most horrific horror, the tragic, violent death of their siblings, their dad, their mom, their cousin, their uncle, their little sister, and having to figure out how to put that into perspective in their life. And I watched young adults go from very angry, revengeful people to become understanding and open-hearted individuals that were willing to live in honor of their loved ones. That's what VIPI has to offer our communities, our police departments, the county attorney's offices are in support. We have a little bit of programming available to homicide survivors through the county attorney's office and the victim witness advocacy program. But it's a very short-term service that's only available while you're in the judicial process. It took the St. Paul Police Department 4.5 months to solve my son's murder. During that 4.5 months, I had no contact from the county. Then during the cases, there were 8 people responsible for my son's death, and so there was 8 different defendants with 8 different everything, and the county attorney's office helped me through all of that. But then once it's done, it's done. It's not an ongoing service available to folks that face what you face when homicide, suicide, or accidental death come into your life. There isn't anything else for suicide and accidental death. The group situations, meeting weekly and walking through and talking through this until we can live with it, is instrumental in creating healed people. People that can give back to the community. I've since become involved in the Restorative Justice Advisory Council of Minnesota and have wonderful explanations and attitudes about all of that as well. I can't imagine ever being able to get there without having had VIPI initially. The one thing, there's many things to say, and I hope you have time to read through some of the personal stories that folks have shared. There's a lot of people that had a lot to say about what VIPI has done in their lives, and I hope you'll take the time to learn it from their personal experiences. I really challenge each and every one of you to walk in my shoes and those of the people like me. Your sister, your brother, your son, your grandma, your mom can face murder, complete a suicide, or have an accidental death. Where do you go for help? Who's going to be there for you? I hope they're the same people that were there for me, that offered me hope and gave me the vision and the tools to take myself from that very, very painful place into living in honor of my loved one. I'd like to share a little picture of Josh. This is just him from baby to big, so you can see he's a real life, he was a real life person, and somebody that I'm very proud of and knew, he knew how to love and be loved and wouldn't be capable of doing what was done to him.
Thank you, Sue. And Mr. Chair, there are other people here that have been affected by the victim intervention program, and I would like them to stand now.
Please do.
And they came just to offer support and to tell the committee how much the program helped them. And I renew my motion.
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to hear from the homicide commander from the St. Paul Police Department for just a moment?
It would.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tim Lynch. I'm the Senior Commander in Charge of the Homicide Unit for St. Paul Police Department. In addition to all the stories that you could hear, some of the things that you've seen written in front of you, the letters, I would tell you that that is the, for me, that is an important thing that we're able to provide, healing and help for the victims. But over and above that, this organization, in my view, helps us solve homicides. It frees up my investigators. People who are victims, their family members are victims. They want to call and find out what's going on, and it takes a lot of time out of my investigators' day to respond to those issues. They try to do what they can, but some of the things we have to keep secret until the investigations are progressed along far enough. But VIPI serves as liaison between the families and us, and they get what they need, and they know what the families need because they're all survivors themselves. And it frees up my investigators' times so that they don't have to not only deal with all the little questions that people have, but also to sit face-to-face with an emotional survivor to try to get past that, to remain, you know, calm and collected in their investigation. It's difficult. But I want to tell you that really the bottom line for me is that this organization serves the communities in a spectacular way. The demand is huge, and it helps solve homicide cases.
Matter of letters, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Ms. Maher, thank you. And everyone in the audience who is also coming today, Representative Murphy, thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Chair laid over on the table for possible inclusion. Representative Paymar, House File 3320. Representative, Paymar, before you start, we may be right now informing Representative Hillstrom we're going to move her bill over to tomorrow to give you a little extra time, but I would like to conclude by 1:45. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3320 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And, Mr. Chair, for because we have limited time, I'm just going to briefly explain the bill and turn it over to the testifiers. Essentially, what we're asking for is $100,000 from the general fund to go to Ramsey County for to implement the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Pilot Project. I'm passing out some articles that were in the Star Tribune that really tell the scope of the story and the horror that is facing young girls, primarily young girls, in the metropolitan area. Some of these girls are being trafficked and prostituted as young as 11 years of age, and this is particularly acute in the Asian community and moreover in the Hmong community in St. Paul. And so what we're wanting to do here is to use this money to train law enforcement, to train other interveners who will identify these victims of sexual assault and exploitation, with the eye towards reuniting them with their families, getting them back into schools, and stopping the sexual violence. So with me today to explain the project and the problem in more detail, I introduce Laurel Edinburgh, who works with the Midwest Children's Resource Center in St. Paul at St. Paul Children's Hospital. And she's worked with sexually exploited youth, mostly of Hmong heritage, and has worked with the St. Paul Asian Gang Strike Force, and let her provide the testimony. And there are other people here to provide supporting testimony if needed.
Very good. Nurse Edinburgh, give us your full name for the record and then go ahead.
My name is Laurel Edinburgh, and thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman. I'm here really to talk about a profound change that I've seen in the past 6 years when I've been working at the Midwest Children's Resource Center. We've seen a dramatic increase in the number of very young teens who are presenting to our clinic for sexual assault. Most of these teens have run away from home. They've been truant from school. And the majority are also children of immigrant families. To give you an idea of the numbers, of how the numbers have increased, between 1998 and 2002, we only saw 33 teens in our center who had four or more separate perpetrators. But in 2003, we've had 15 teens with four or more perpetrators.
Nurse Edinburgh, let's, we're going to have to suspend. We're under an obligation to remove ourselves from the premises. This committee stands in recess.